You're tuned into R1 News at 1. Every weekday from 1 till 2 p.m, our dedicated news team brings you the hard-hitting stories, interviews and culture pieces from across Aotearoa Dunedin.
Kia ora and welcome to R1 News at 1. I'm Jonah. You're listening to Radio 191 FM. We're just going to dive straight into the headlines today.
Here are the R1 News at 1 headlines.
This is the R1 News Bulletin for Wednesday, 19th of June. I'm Jonah. In national news, last week, the Waitangi Tribunal inquiry into the use of te reo Māori in the public sector concluded with an emotional final day. RNZ reports. The Tauranga-based iwi, Ngāti Rangi, filed the application in December last year. This followed the new government instructing public sector departments to prioritise English language names as part of the coalition agreement with New Zealand First. Affected departments included the New Zealand Transport Agency Waka Kotahi, which has begun referring to itself with its English name first. Since December, Minister for the Public Service Nicola Willis has not issued directives to the public sector on the topic, instead leaving the decision to individual ministers. Last Friday, Annette Sykes, a lawyer for the claimants, accused the government of dismantling the protections for te reo Māori that she has fought for over the years. Another claimant lawyer, Matanuku Mahuika, said that asking Māori to blindly trust the Crown was, quote, gaslighting. Crown Counsel Seb Bisley denied this, stating that the coalition agreements were not the same as Crown actions. Judge Takani Williams became visibly emotional during his final statement and thanked the claimants and lawyers who had shared their thoughts and korero. Judge Williams said that the Waitangi Tribunal would aim to complete a comprehensive report on the inquiry by the end of the year. Minister for Resources Shane Jones has confirmed that the government will reverse the ban on oil and gas exploration. The bill to enact the changes is said to be introduced in the second half of this year. Jones said that New Zealand's natural gas reserves were declining and therefore exploration of new sources was needed. He said that natural gas is critical to New Zealand's power grid and that, quote, intermittent renewable sources like wind, solar and hydro were inconsistent. Offshore petroleum exploration was banned in 2018 by the previous Labour-led government. Jones also seeks to incentivize oil investors by paying them a bond in case their mining rights are cancelled by future governments. The opposition has criticized the move. Green Party co-leader Chloe Swarbrick accused the government of, quote, tipping oil and gas onto the climate crisis fire. Last Thursday, Dr. Jen Purdy, a senior research fellow at the University of Otago's Center of Sustainability, published a piece in Newsroom criticizing the government's plans. Dr. Purdy argued that the plans do not make environmental or economic sense because global demand for oil will likely peak soon. Dr. Purdy will join us live on air for an interview shortly to discuss her piece, so stay tuned. In student news, the government has told Te Pūkenga to resume cost-cutting and asset sales at its polytechnics. This follows the disestablishment of Te Pūkenga by the National Party started in December of last year, in which they were ordered to stop work as an entity and re-establish into its regional polytechs. In a letter of expectation sent out last month, Tertiary Education Minister Penny Simmons expects the institution to continue to provide education and training to its students as normal, while it improves its financial sustainability through regional decision-making and working with the government. It is the second letter sent to Te Pūkenga from the minister. Speaking to RNZ, the Tertiary Education Union said that the directive would create more stress and uncertainty for under-pressure staff, and that the recent letter appears to contradict some of the government's initial instructions. Union Assistant Secretary Daniel Benson-Goyi said it was hard to consider whether those cuts would come from an established and described the Te Pūkenga cut situation as a, quote, elastic band that's been stretched and stretched, and there's no more stretch left. He also said that staff should be actively involved in discussions about the polytechnic's future, and people in every part of the country should have access to consistent, high-quality education and training at their local polytech. In international news, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has dissolved his war cabinet as of Monday this week. Now, Israel's war policies will be approved by Netanyahu's security cabinet, a larger body that is dominated by members opposing the US-backed ceasefire proposal and want to continue with the war on Gaza. Associated Press and Al Jazeera both report consultations made by the Israeli former war cabinet will now be made between Netanyahu and his close allies. The former war cabinet was made up of six members, including Netanyahu, his former political rival Benny Gantz, and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, and three observers, also ministers. On the 9th of June, Gantz and an observer, Gadi Eisenkot, quit the war cabinet over the lack of a plan for Gaza beyond the current assault. Gantz has been considered a centrist member of the cabinet and accused Netanyahu of mismanaging the war effort and putting his own political survival over the country's security needs. Yoav Gallant, has previously said he would resign if Israel chose to reoccupy Gaza, and encouraged the government to make plans for a Palestinian administration. Gallant will continue on in Netanyahu's body of consultants. This has been the R1 News Bulletin for Wednesday, 19th of June. Today's bulletin was written by Jonah Broughton and Jemima Lorimer, and read to you by Jonah Broughton.
Those were the headlines for today on R1 News at 1. Catch up on previous R1 News wherever you get your podcasts, or head to r1.co.nz/news.
Kia ora and welcome back to R1 News. Today we have Dr. Jen Purdy joining us today. Dr. Jen Purdy is a senior research fellow at the Center for Sustainability here at Otago. Her research interests lie in the nexus between climate and energy. Dr. Purdy joins us live this afternoon to discuss her recent piece in Newsroom on the government's reversal on the ban of oil and gas mining. Kia ora, Jen. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Kia ora, Jana. Nice to be here.
So if we could just start off by asking you, in your piece, you claim that the government's plan doesn't make sense because of global demand for oil likely peaking soon. Could you just expand and explain that for us a little bit?
Yeah, so there's been lots of articles written about banning oil and gas exploration, and they tend to come from the perspective of climate change and that we should stop, that all fossil fuels should stay in the ground if we want to reach our Paris commitment goals of keeping global temperatures below 1.5 or 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. So I decided to take it from a slightly different perspective, which is that it doesn't make economic sense to drill for oil. If I looked at about 20 different big agencies, oil companies, the International Energy Agency, a whole lot of people, and most of them agree that global oil demand is going to start heading down in the next few years, and that oil investment is tailing off because of that. And so the government is proposing to give a bond to energy companies, to oil companies, to get them to come here and drill, partly because investors are shaky on oil. And I'm just saying, and also the government's talking about taking away the rule that says that they have to clean up their mess when they leave, or at least watering that rule down. And so I'm saying that none of that makes economic sense in a sunset industry.
And just on Shane Jones's claims and the government's claims that these renewable sources that we're seeking to expand, like hydro, wind, solar, they're quite inconsistent. Is that true?
Yeah, so our current electricity system is 85% renewable, and New Zealand energy is 40% renewable, and that's because we have a huge amount of cars and trucks on the road, and they use petrol. So electricity, though, is 85% renewable, and electricity only produces 5% of our emissions. So we're ramping up renewables. Renewables are by far the cheapest thing to build now, so as new electricity generation is being built, it is renewable that's getting built because it's cheapest. Electricity demand is going to double in the next 30 years because we're going to electrify everything we possibly can. So we're electrifying the vehicle fleet, and most places around the world are going to be pure electric vehicles and get rid of petrol vehicles by about 2040. So we're electrifying everything. We're going to double the electricity demand. We're building a whole lot of renewables because of that. We've got to build about 2 wind or solar farms a year out till 2050 to supply the electricity that's needed for that electrification to decarbonise the economy. But the trouble with renewables is they're intermittent. So when the wind stops blowing and the sun stops shining, you've got to firm them up with something. So you've got to have something to turn on. Now, in New Zealand, we're really lucky because 55% of our electricity is generated from hydro. And what we can do with hydro is we close the gates and hang on to the water when the wind's blowing. And when the wind stops blowing, we can open the gates and generate with that water. So that's awesome. But what happens in New Zealand sometimes is we get a dry year or a dry period. And at that point, yeah, intermittent renewables are a bit of a problem. And there's about 5 ways we can fix that. We could build a pumped storage scheme like Lake Onslow that was talked about a while ago. That's been shelved by the government at the moment. It was an expensive solution, but it would have sort of solved that problem. Or we can overbuild, so we can build 100 wind farms in the hope that 50 of them will be blowing at any one time. We can get grid-scale batteries. Probably one of the biggest tools we're going to have is demand response. So that's where you come home from work at 5 o'clock and you plug in your electric car, but it doesn't start charging till 2 a.m. when nobody else wants that electricity. And also big industrials. So any big industrial in New Zealand coming and looking for an electricity provider is now going to find, and this has been the case for the last couple of years, that the electricity provider asks them to back off at 6 p.m. in winter when all the residents all need that electricity. So those are all the different ways. Also a bit of biofuels and some hydrogen. So this is talked about as the portfolio approach. So we're going to have a whole lot of little things that are going to help us with that intermittency. And there are quite a few countries in the world that are 100% renewable already, and they're all using some combination of those things to get there.
But even in we have a decarbonised strategy like that, you'd still need some form of fossil fuels to have almost a backup.
Yeah, and New Zealand needs to be net zero by 2050. That's our goal under the Zero Carbon Act. And so we can have some fossil fuels left. And to do that, we need to be able to soak up that carbon in some way through planting trees or carbon capture and storage. But most of the fossil fuels we need to get rid of. I'm a proponent for keeping a little tiny bit of gas in the electricity system because the Interim Climate Change Committee and the Climate Change Commission both said that if we get rid of all of the gas out of the system and then we have a dry year, it doesn't work very well. So it would be great to have a tiny bit of gas in there. And that tiny bit of gas enables us to decarbonise a huge number of cars. So, yeah, there's ways to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. So full electrification, but still some. A bit of fossil fuel and natural gas in the tank, just in case. Okay, moving forward, what should New Zealand do in terms of government policy and for climate and energy policy, expanding on what you have talked
about?
Yeah,
well, I think the big left-right divide is so we have an emissions trading scheme where carbon is priced. Half of our emissions come from agriculture, and that is currently exempt from the emissions trading scheme. So I think the big divide is where the people on the right think that the emissions trading scheme is enough and that will get us to where we need to go to reach our Paris targets. And the people more on the left are thinking that that's not enough. And I think there's good research that I've seen to back that up, that we need to do more than just have a price on carbon on half of our emissions. So the other things the last government was doing were incentivising people buying clean cars. So electric cars were a bit cheaper and big gas guzzlers were more expensive. People need to drive smaller cars. People need to not fly so much. But the government needs to incentivise all these measures. We need to get agriculture into some sort of plan to reduce their emissions. And the government has just kicked that down the road a bit. We need to incentivise public transport, make that much more cheap and regular, work on cycleways, get people walking, get them out of their cars, incentivise electric cars and people driving smaller cars. My mind's gone blank. Yeah, the whole range of measures, really, which I think all speed us along, because the energy transition is now inevitable. It is going to happen. Renewables are the cheapest thing to build. There's absolutely no doubt that that's going to happen. Most countries around the world are going to get rid of petrol cars by 2040. All of this is just unstoppable now. The thing that's the problem is the speed. And so government policies speed things up, and that's what we need. We're not going fast enough. And New Zealand is doing much less than its fair share per capita in reducing emissions. So we're a small country, we don't have many emissions, but per person we're actually really high.
In the face of that sort of inevitability, are you an optimist about the future of the energy transition?
Yes, I am, because I think I've been working in this field for 30 years now, and the changes I've seen in that time are quite remarkable. Remember that the world went from 100% horse to 100% car in about 13 years back at the beginning of last century. So we can move fast when we want to. We got rid of CFCs with the Montreal Protocol in 1976, where the whole world signed a protocol and got rid of CFCs, which fixed the ozone hole. mostly. So we can move fast. And the other thing is that when I started working in this field, the globe was heading towards a 4 to 6 degrees temperature rise. That was what was projected by the end of the century. And that's now looking at about 2 degrees, about if everyone does what they've promised to do, about 1.8 degree warming by the end of the century. But if we look at actual policies that governments have already got in place, it's more like sort of 2.1 to 2.7 degrees. So that's scary, and there's going to be massive changes, but I think the momentum is there. We just need to move faster. So, yeah, I'm optimistic.
And in the context of New Zealand, we obviously have a government that seems to be backtracking on a lot of the things you've been advocating for. In that context, what can we as individuals do in terms of being climate friendly?
Yeah, well, I haven't got it in front of me, but Dr. Michael Mann is a very famous, world-famous climate scientist, and he always said, you know, do little things yourself, don't fly, drive less, etc. But the best thing anyone can do is to push governments to act in the interest of the people, not the lobbyists. And I think that's really, really important. So write to your politicians, you know, write to Minister of Resources Shane Jones, Minister of Climate Change, the Minister of Energy, and the Prime Minister, and tell them you insist, particularly if you're a young person and you're going to be on this planet for another 60 to 80 years, you don't want to deal with the consequences of, for example, a 1 metre sea level rise, where 150 million people in the world are going to be looking for a new home, and do you have a spare bed at your house? You know, you young people are the people that should be really pressuring governments now to move faster.
Mm-hmm. Just before we wrap up, anything else you'd like to add? Any final thoughts you'd like to share at all?
No, I think be optimistic, but pressure governments. I think we need to move faster to prevent cataclysmic climate change. And the scary thing over 2 degrees is the feedback mechanisms where things might get really out of control. So we need to keep that pressure on.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much, Jen, for joining us. It's been a really good chat to have, and really important topic. So thanks very much.
Kia ora. Thanks, Jana.
Kia ora. Next up, we've got Te Utu o Te Aotearoa by Louis Baker.
You've been listening to R1 News at 1, here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. The R1 News is uploaded daily wherever you get your podcasts. Or head to r1.co.nz/news to get yourself all caught up. Additionally, you can follow R1 News NZ to keep up to date with all our newsworthy happenings.